Okay. Hi, I'm Brent. If we've never met, I work here, evidently, sometimes. In case you didn't know, I have been gone for a little bit more than 3 months on a sabbatical, and this is my first official Sunday back and preaching in the pulpit, as we say. Sabbatical is just kind of a fancy word for time away. It's something that they encourage in the United Methodist Church, of which we are part of that tradition, for ordained pastors and for clergy to really just get some time away once every 7 to 10 years and just have a time of rest and renewal and learning. And so I am officially back as of this week. And thank you for, in particular, thank each and every one of you for how you made that time possible. And it really is a thanks to every single one of you. So many volunteers stepped up into various roles to make everything sort of like keep going and even improved. All of our committees that supported me in that process, the Lilly Foundation, who wrote a great check to pay for the whole thing. And also then for our staff, each and every one of them doing more across every single week, and to do all of that made it possible, and in particular to Molly as our associate pastor who served as lead pastor the whole time. Yeah. So thank you. It's really good to be back, and I missed you. One of the things that I get asked, as you might imagine, every time I see someone and I'm new back in the space is, well, how was it? And I want to apologize in advance for my answer to this, if you've asked me already or if you're going to ask me, because I don't feel good about my response. I will just own that. It's just that it's such a large question, and the effects of that time away and what I learned and experienced, I just don't know how to give a good, concise answer to that question while also sort of like observing things like your time and your availability and your interest level. But if you do want, I do have a really long slideshow that I'm going to share with you this morning. No, I'm just kidding. I was like, don't make that joke. They might think you're serious. But I did it anyway. Oh, well. But I do feel like while it's really, really hard to say, like, here's what it meant, it's like someone asking me, what's the ocean like? Gosh, where do I start? I do feel like there was maybe like 2 or 3 experiences that in some way could be focal points for that entire experience. And it's one of those that I want to share with you this morning. And it was a visit to a Stone Age burial mound in the center of Ireland, a place called Newgrange. It's a huge mound. It was constructed more than 5,000 years ago. It towers up 50 feet tall at its center. It's more than 300 feet wide at all of its diameter. But part of what makes this place called Newgrange so amazing and so impactful in our visit was not just that we get to see it, but get this, you get to go inside. It was the most like Indiana Jones I've ever felt in my life. And I've been searching since I was like 10 and saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. And this was that moment. But there was something about that experience, more than any other, that I think gave me an insight. You arrive pretty early on. They put you on a shuttle bus and they take you. Excuse me, 1 second. I'm going. And because it's so old, they only bring you in groups of about 6 or 8 at a time. They lined us up at the center. They told you to make sure that nothing was going to rub on the edges of this passageway of this burial tomb. And then they start walking you inside. They were like, line up. Who wants to be first? I was like, absolutely me. Excuse me. I went in right after the guide. What are those? Tic Tacs? Heck, I love candy. I don't know. Might. Thank you, Marlou. I just chewed that. That's not going to help. Thank you, though. It's a bad habit. It's time to go inside the tomb, okay? We ready? Here we go. You have to lean over. It's in its original state from more than 5,000 years ago. And as we crawl inside and you're working your way through, your back hunched over because the stones have started to lean in on the edges. We worked our way all the way to the end with the guide. And when we got to the end, there was a small round opening. There was one small sort of burial place here, one to the left and one to the right. So we all got inside and sort of circled up. The guide began to show us what we were seeing. "Look at the roof," he said. "Excuse me. It's been stacked with stones so perfectly that it's never leaked. This is Ireland. You build something that doesn't leak in San Diego, yeah, nice job. Ireland, though. Why do I have... Okay. Oh, thank you. Oh, that's hot." "Thank you, though. You look around, it's amazing." He says, "If you notice," he says, "the floor is slightly sloped." He said, "The most notable thing about this place is what happens on one morning of the year, shortest day of the year, as the sun rises. On the winter solstice, shortest day of the year," he said, "a small beam of light comes in from a small gap above where you came in, and it illuminates a long light that comes right to the center of the chamber." And he says, "And we have a light set up to demonstrate this for you. He said, "So in a few moments, I'm going to turn off all the lights, and we're going to turn on this small light to show you what it would have been like to stand in this tomb on the winter solstice and to see that ray of light come in." He says, "We don't know exactly why it was built this way, that it, as the sun comes up on that, the shortest day of the year." He's like, "But anthropologists tell us that it's probably reasonable to assume that with maybe some sort of sense that that light might be in some ways a bridge or understood to be a pathway, even figuratively, to help the people who rest in the tomb move from the here and now to the world to come." And so he says, "I'm going to turn off the lights, make sure you stay where you are, and then I'll turn on the light to simulate it." And I sort of backed up to get my back against something so nothing could get behind me, and the lights went off. And it would be a few moments later when he would turn on this small bulb, a little bit dim, and then brighter and brighter, and you could see how it cut right across the floor, right to the center of this tomb, built with this precision that more than 5,000 years ago, they could know where the sun would come up on this, the shortest day of the year, and would beam this light to this place. But it was the appearance of that light that was not the moment that was the perfect experience. That moment of experience was for me actually those few lingering moments in the dark waiting for the light. Because as the lights went down and I could no longer see who was around me, I could no longer see or hear the guide, I couldn't see what people were wearing, our tote bags and our umbrellas and our shoes and all of the modern clothing that we were wearing, there was something about standing there in the dark that I thought to myself, this is what they felt. This is what it was like more than 5,000 years ago to stand in this darkness and to wait for the light. There was something so human about it, something wildly human and existential about realizing that people more than 5,000 years ago, 3,000 years before Jesus. So long that Jesus, God of the universe, is like, wow, that's a long time ago. That's old. The people had built this place because they were concerned about a question. That they wondered, what comes next? What's the life like after this one? What's the world to come? And maybe in some senses, as the light came in, how do we get from here to that world to come? It was so human, so real, so human to ask that question, to build a monument to help people think about that question. what is to come? What's the life like after this one, and how do we get there? And even sadly, as Heather pointed out at one point, touched by the humanness of our original sin, that even that place was touched by social stratification, that only maybe three people were worthy, according to them, of being buried there. The most human of experiences. And I tell you that story this morning not only as sort of just like a small entryway into my time, but as an entryway into our passage this morning. Because I think that one of the things that Jesus is most concerned about in this passage that Kathy read for us earlier are these questions. What happens next? What is the world to come? Whether individually or what world comes after this one? And how do we move from the here and now to there? And to understand sort of like what happens in this story, Jesus has gone to someone's house for sort of like a banquet. And as he does, it says that he sits down and the religious leaders are watching him closely. And as he noticed how guests chose places of honor, it says that he told them a parable. Parables are situations that Jesus will use in the Gospels. And a great way to understand it is that a parable is in some senses kind of like that beam of light that showed on the floor of that tomb. A parable is understood to be something that's a point or a message about how we move from here and now and what we know and experience to God's coming kingdom. How do we move from here and now to what's next? Parables will use everyday experiences that we know in here and now to point the way to what is to come. And so he sees all of these guests and the way that they're jockeying for position, and he begins to tell them a parable. Something not just about that situation, but something about the world that he believes is to come. And he tells them this. He says, listen up, everybody. When you're invited to a banquet, a wedding banquet, which would have been a really, really big deal, where you sat would afford your family certain rights, certain benefits, who you would get to do business with, how your family would be fed, how people would treat you, maybe even what sort of tombs you might be buried in after your life. And so it would be a very serious situation where you sat. And he notices people sort of jockeying for position, and he says to everybody, he's like, you guys are doing it wrong. When you get to a wedding banquet, don't, so to speak, push your luck. Don't try to say, I bet I'm a little bit higher than this guy, but that's a really good shirt, so I'm going to be like right in the center here, and I feel pretty good about this. He says, because if you do that, what happens possibly is that the host comes in and someone more important than you shows up. And the host says, buddy, this is probably their spot. And rather than moving everybody down, he just says, why don't you just go to the end? He says, think about it. If that happens, it's going to be pretty embarrassing. He says, why don't you instead do this? You go and you sit at the lowest place. Start at the far end of the table. And what happens then is the host will come in and be like, buddy, what are you doing down here? Come on up. Come closer. I want you to sit up here with me. Now, I want you to understand that I don't think Jesus is really just giving good social advice here, okay? I don't really think that's his jam, to be honest. But this is a parable. He's using the situation in the here and now to talk about the world to come, what is next, which is something that he makes clear in this next statement. His point of all of this is to say this: for all of those one day who have exalted themselves, who have taken more than their fair share, who have built and lifted themselves up, they will be humbled. While those who have humbled themselves through their life, they will be exalted. Jesus is shockingly clear here about what the world to come will be like. And while he doesn't really flesh it out, what he tells us is very, very consistent with what he says in so many of the other Gospels, when he says things like, the first shall be last, and last shall be first. What they said in the announcement of his coming, when John the Baptist says, the mountains will be brought low and the valleys high. Blessed are the poor, for they will laugh. and they will celebrate. Woe to those who have power, for you will weep. Jesus is strongly clear here about what the world to come will look like, and it will look like profound reversal, an inversion, a revolution in the highest, strongest sense of the word. That if we think about the social structure of our world, whether 5,000 years ago to Jesus' time to today, he doesn't just say it's going to even out. That's an easier sermon, I'll be honest with you. No, he says it's going to flip. It's going to be the opposite. A complete inversion. Which is a message that he continues in the next part. I always picture him sort of saying this to the guest and the host being like, yeah, good one, Jesus. Look at them all scrambling. And Jesus turns to the host and is like, actually, I got something for you too. He says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, he's like, let me be honest, you kind of messed up here today. It's like you invited your friends, invited your relatives, you invited other powerful people. He's like, it's not bad, but it's just kind of a mistake. Because what's going to happen is that everybody here, the next time they throw a party, they're going to invite you, and that's your payment. That's what you get in return. You just keep up with the system, the social stratification, keeping everybody up top who's up top. He's like, here's what you actually should do. He's like, when you give a banquet, you need to invite those who don't have the means or ability in his day and age to be able to throw you a banquet in return. You need to invite those whose lives are marked by poverty. You need to invite those that were disabled, which in Jesus' time and place would have come with a very, very particular type of poverty on its own, with no social safety nets. He says, this is who you need to invite when you throw a party. And he says, and here's why. Because you'll be blessed, not just by going to another party later, but because these people will not be able to repay you in this life, in this world. But you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. The actual Greek for that is when the righteous stand up, which I like. Because we're waiting for the righteous to stand up sometimes, aren't we? Maybe that's what it's going to look like when the kingdom and the world to come shows up, is that the righteous stand up and take a stand together. Jesus' point, though, seems to be something like God's going to repay you on their behalf at that heavenly banquet table. Or maybe even better, they're going to be the ones that get to host. You're going to be the ones that host. And you'll decide the seating order, maybe. It's two different stories, one to the guests and one to the host, but they're united by this idea. They're united by this very, very clear, strong vision of what the world to come will look like. And it will be an inversion of the power structure that we know. It will be a revolution. It will be a place that for each and every one of us and those in this world who have been told by the power structures of churches and governments and politics and economics that their place is not at the table, it will look like their place is centered at the table. For each and every one, Jesus says in essence to his followers, if you want to move from the here and now to what's to come, start living like it now. Change how you throw your parties. Change who you center at your tables. Change how you spend your money. Change how you act. Change how you pray. Remember the world to come. Act and live like it's true now. Almost like standing in that tomb, seeing that faint little glimmer of light getting brighter and brighter and brighter, and knowing that it's happening. Jesus says to the church and his followers, be really, really clear about your priorities, about who you center, especially in a world and in a country marked by this administration. That's not Jesus' words, but I like to think that's what he would say right now as the preacher. An administration that, as I watched from afar, has become particularly cruel and adept at setting up social stratifications and moving people away from the table of what we have to offer as a community. How they treat the unhoused in Washington, D.C. using the National Guard. How they treat our immigrants. How they treat people of color. And ICE using racist policies to just harass people. How they treat the LGBTQ community, and in particular trans women. How they treat people dependent on government services like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Jesus says to the church, using this example of a banquet, church, you better be real, real clear about your priorities, because they are. And you need to be clear about who you center, who you value, who you make space for at the table. And I said this earlier, it's a much easier message and story if Jesus just said, hey, there's room for everybody equally. You got to value everyone. And I don't think he's saying that we don't value everyone, but he's talking about priorities. He's talking about where the people of God will put their money, how they will use their building, who they will pray for when they pray at night, first and foremost. Jesus' message seems to be, remember the people who are being pushed away, and you put them first. Friends, if you are pushed away, if you have been pushed away by a church, I want you to know that this church prioritizes you, that you have a central place in this community. If you are pushed away by this government and its policies, we affirm and confirm and reaffirm your priority in this community and in this country. As we are people who stand in the darkness waiting for light to show up, let us remember who we are called to prioritize, where you are prioritized. And in this, we wait and watch for the world to come. Amen.